Peter strolling through the crowd like Peter Lorre contemplating a crime. She comes out of the sun in a silk dress, running like a watercolor in the rain. Don't bother asking for explanation, she'll just tell you that she came in the year of the cat. Time for questions as she locks up your arms and hers, and you follow till your sense of which direction completely disappears. By the blue tiled walls near the market stalls, there's a hidden door she leads you to. These days she says, I feel my life just like a river running through. The year of the cat. Well, she looks at you so coolly, and her eyes shine like the moon in the sea. She comes in incense and patchouli. So you take her to find what's waiting inside. The year of the cat.
That's Al Stewart and The Year of the Cat, selected by our guest today, who is a man I've known since I was 22 years of age. And he was just a cool dude swanning around town, and I met him through my then-girlfriend. And then I heard on the grapevine that he was starting some flying lessons. in his mid-20s, with the view of perhaps becoming a pilot. And I thought, well, he's leaving his run a bit late, being in the mid-20s and going for your first flying lesson. Then lo and behold, he starts flying for a whole lot of people, including Ansett. And then they went bust and they forced him overseas. So he was flying for Vietnam Airlines, Pacific Airlines. He went and flew for Air Malta, Azura Air. He delivered an Airbus for a shake, and then he ends up, from his first flying lesson down at Moorabbin, he ends up as a captain of the Emirates A380 planes flying around the world. James Nixon, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you, Daz? And would you know, 25 years after I started flying, I flew the A380 over the Melbourne Cup.
Did you?
And it was exactly the same place that Robbie Maslin took me in Cessna Delta Mike Quebec out of Essendon. My very first flight, flew over Flemington Racecourse. 25 years later, I flew over in the A380.
That is a great story, and that from the start of your career to the end of it, that's a beauty. But look, we've got so much to talk about, but first up, that song, great song by Al Stewart, Year of the Cat. Our resident music guy, Alan Howe, has said that the song was originally about the comedian Tony Hancock, and it's featuring a never-until-then-played alto sax owned for a few weeks, by a man killed in the first days of World War II, recorded at Abbey Road, that song. I didn't know any of that, but you have a different story.
Well, no, it's partly the same story. It's about that song. And that song, the reason I like it is because on the 6th of March, 1977, I turned 18 and got my driver's license. And it was a hot, sunny day. And they played that song. Every second song was that on high rotation when it first came out.
I just
got my mum's Gemini and I drove and drove and drove and drove. And I got to a place called Portsea.
Yeah.
And the army man stopped me going any further when we got to Portsea.
That's right.
So I turned around and went back to Melbourne. And then I got back to Melbourne and thought, this is good fun. Turned around and went back again.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And I get down to Portsea again and he comes over. He puts his hand up, makes me stop the car. He says, come over here. I said, yes, what is it, sir? He says, did you just get your driver's license today?
Yeah.
And I said, yes. He says, yeah, we get two of you a day.
Is that right? Just coming up and back from Portsea. That brings back fond memories because the song, I reckon, when I first got my license was Dragon. And April Sun in Cuba off the album O Zambezia. And I had a cassette player, a Pioneer cassette player, in the Tirana HB in the back blocks of Rye. Similar story, just playing Dragon.
So I was driving to my first ever lesson on how to be a pilot, where not a lesson, an exam that I had to do.
Yeah.
First exam for flying. And all of a sudden on the radio, that song comes on. And I thought, this could be an omen.
Oh.
So I got 100% for that exam.
Yeah.
The first exam I ever got A+ for. The only other time I ever got A+ in my life was for my blood test. And I suddenly found something that I was good at.
Yeah.
And I did the next 23 subjects and became a pilot.
Well, as a pilot, you've written quite a few books. And in fact, one has landed on the desk that you brought in, 23 Tips to Survive a Long Flight. But you've written a book on the MH370, which we'll talk about a bit later on. But what a career you've had, and an inspiration to me too, for someone I was a bit sceptical thinking, because was that fair in my introduction, saying that to start flying in mid-20s with the view of becoming a commercial pilot was a bit out there?
Yeah, when I started, most of the people were starting at 16.
Yeah.
You get your license at 16.
Yeah.
And they'd be hanging out at the airport, you know, painting rocks white, mowing lawns, doing anything they could to get free flying hours.
Yes.
And I never could do that. So, I was inspired by a teacher at school to be a pilot when I was in about year nine. And I decided I want to be a pilot. Based on this guy had been a Catalina pilot in the Second World War.
Right.
And later on, a science teacher told me I was too stupid to do science, and I believed him.
Oh,
A dream stealer. And what he didn't know...
He was a dream stealer.
If you steal someone's dream to stop them doing science, they can't do physics, and that means they can never fly. So that destroyed me from flying until I was 26. I had my own business and made enough money. And Robert Maslin, who I was a very good mate of, and he was a commercial instructor, and he kept saying every morning, when are we going to teach you to fly? And one morning I said, let's have a go.
And that sends shivers up my spine. I didn't know that. So getting back to that dream stealer at work,
yep,
at school, I mean, Did he ever find out that you eventually became a captain with Emirates on the A380s?
No, but I actually became, I still kept in touch with a maths teacher who inspired me, Ralph Schinkfield, who had been a Catalina pilot in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And I've written 5 books now. Every book, he gets the first copy.
Oh.
And he was in his 90s, just died last year at 93. And we've been in touch for all those years.
So, what a great start. Look, there's a rescue you were involved with. I want to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you about the theories of MH370. I want to find out what it's like flying an A380 Airbus from four Emirates and flying over the Melbourne Cup. James Nixon is here, retired pilot, a man I've known for 40 years.
How low can you fly this thing responsibly, James?
Responsibly?
No.
Well, as our passengers will attest, coming in from Dubai, we can slide right down to the ground responsibly. But usually it's only when there's an airport in front of us.
Yes.
Today, responsibly, we can responsibly fly it down to 500 feet over.
Wow.
But we're not going to. We're going to fly it down to 1,000 feet today over the race course because we don't want to scare the horses today.
Yeah, of course.
That was, of course, Ross and John. Just prior to you flying the A380 Airbus at 1,000 feet across Flemington Racecourse, as described earlier.
Yes, it's a long affinity with 3AW. I've been involved with AW since my sister worked here many, many years
ago. What did your sister do here?
She was Bill and David Mann's secretary many, many years ago. When I was 14, I came here as a kid to 382 La Trobe Street and met Claudia Wright, who showed me the naked man behind the back of her office door. That's another story. And then I've been hanging out with AW for all these years, did beach promotions and stuff, and for some reason I do crosses to them from aeroplanes. So I did a live cross to the Breakfast Show from the when we brought the Olympic Flame from New Zealand to Ayers Rock.
Yes.
I did a talk to the Breakfast guys and that one there as well, talking to Ross and John about bringing the A380 over the Melbourne Cup.
James Nixon is here, a retired Emirates A380 captain. The Saabs, before you got to Air Ansett, who were you flying for? Kendall Airlines, wasn't it?
Yep.
Who are now sort of Rex, aren't
they?
Yeah, Kendall became Rex. And you're in the Saabs?
Saab 340 and the Metros.
And the Metros.
I was a Metro captain and then went to Ansett.
Now, Ansett, there is a story. You still keep in touch with a lot of the Ansett people because I reckon you once said to me that if Ansett had kept going, you would have been a career pilot with Ansett because you love them.
Yeah, it was a big family and it still is a big family. And every time anyone's in trouble, or there's anything going on, we're all friends with each other. One of our cabin crew had a brain tumour and we raised money for Charlie Teo to fix her brain.
Yeah.
And we did that in about 3 days and raised enough money for the operation. So it's just incredible how much of a family it is and we still hang out together and we still have annual parties every year. Yeah, it was a great time. I was on the 727 for 5 years and then I went on to the A320 Airbus for another 5 years.
It should it have folded? Why did it fold? My memory is a bit vague on the whole thing. As a captain at the time with Ansett, what actually happened?
No, I was still a first officer.
Oh, you were first officer, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so the reason why it failed, well there's a number of reasons, but the final kicker was 9/11. And 23 airlines in the world failed in the week after 9/11. So, including, you know, South America's number one airline and Brussels' big airline. So it happened after 9/11 because the value of the assets were worth nothing. You couldn't sell an aeroplane the day after 9/11.
Yeah.
So if you had $650 million worth of leases or paying off loans for aeroplanes that had no value, technically you're trading insolvent.
Yes.
And in these days, in the GFC, they changed it so people could trade insolvent. Otherwise, all the airlines would have gone broke again during the COVID and GFC.
Could it have been saved?
I think so. I'm not close enough to it, but I think it could have been saved if there was a desire to do so.
Yeah.
But the government was the Sydney government, and they had to look after their Sydney airline, I think.
Ah, interesting. So on the back of that, you described yourself as an Ansett refugee, and you were sentenced to over 13 years living as an expat Australian.
Yeah, well, I couldn't get any work in Australia because I was an Ansett A320 pilot.
Yeah.
The administrators wouldn't let us go. So all the other people who flew all the other aeroplanes left and got work overseas eventually, but they kept us on because they were selling us as a job lot with the A320s to try and make the airline continue. So we couldn't leave. We couldn't get redundancy. So we had to stay till the end, which is in March 2002. And by that stage, there was no jobs anywhere in Australia. And so I had to go overseas.
So then they cut ties with you, no income. What was your first gig OS?
First gig OS was after the Grand Prix in 2003, the day after. I went over to Malta for a summer contract. Air Malta gave me a summer contract, and that meant 2 or 3 months in living in Malta, training in Malta, flying to the European destinations,
yeah.
And then based in Bristol, flying for their subsidiary, Azzurra Air.
Azzurra Air?
Azzurra Air, from Italy.
From Italy.
Prego.
Uno vino bianco. And Azzurra Air, did you have to do your announcements in Italian?
No.
Bonjour.
Oh, it was funny because they were upset because these guys are flying BA-146s up and down Italy.
Yeah.
And we rock over the top with all these Aussie pilots flying A320s to the Greek islands every day. And they go, how come you're flying at this plane? Now, this should be my plane.
That's funny. And so did you all, as Australian expats, stick together?
Oh, yeah.
It would have been fun, wouldn't it, after ancestors sort of
huge
be
fun.
Living overseas? You're single.
Yep, single and living overseas, and a few of the guys brought their wives over.
Yeah.
And we had a great time in Bristol for that summer, 2003, the hottest summer in England. It got to about 39 degrees or something in Bristol. And, of course, there's not one air conditioner in the entire country.
Right.
And I get to the Thistle Hotel in Bristol, and it's like 38 degrees, and I ring downstairs and said, listen, you know, where's the air conditioner? She says, it's in the cupboard. I go, oh, all that's right. Interesting. So I open it up, and it's a fan.
Is that right? That was your air conditioning.
Everything's double glazed. Yeah, it was great. No one. You didn't have to buy a blanket when you slept in England. That
no. Year. So then, from Malta Air, you went to
Vietnam.
So Vietnam. Now that was a move.
By law, you've got to be current to fly an airplane in Asia. So you have to have flown it in the actual airplane in the previous 6 months.
Yeah.
So having got currency with the operation to the Greek islands every day for 6 months, then I was allowed to go to Vietnam and get a contract with them. So I spent a year with Vietnam Airlines, and then I went to their subsidiary, Pacific Airlines, to become a captain.
And that was your first gig as captain?
It didn't happen. 3 days after I started my command training, they went broke and we got chucked out of the country.
Yeah. Now, I knew there was a sudden departure from Vietnam. So yeah. you have had it hard. Because of the dream, what do you call it? The dream stealer.
The dream stealer.
Put you back 10 years.
Yep.
He knocked you around.
He sure did.
Then Ansett fell apart.
Yep.
Then Air Malta, that was good. Then you left of your own accord, didn't you?
Yeah, Air Malta, after that contract finished, which made me current to go to Vietnam Airlines, I thought I'd be there for 20 years. What a great job.
Yeah.
Six weeks on, 2 weeks off, living in Saigon. What a city.
Yeah.
It's been run by the French for 100 years, so every corner is a coffee palace.
With croissants.
Fantastic bread.
Oh, yeah.
You can get so fat living in Saigon.
Really?
Me. Oh, yeah.
So you loved it in Saigon.
Yeah, it's great.
And then you get your gig as a captain for the first time, and it doesn't happen because they go bust.
That's right. Lefty and Spike come along, repossess the aeroplanes. And I had to leave the country. So then I got a...
how long were you in Vietnam?
19 months.
But you're single this whole time too. And you're still single, aren't you?
Yeah, still single.
I don't think I've ever known you to have a full-time partner, have you? Have you just cut them from the herd along the way? Or what's the story been?
Well, you know.
Just been,
what do you reckon?
Well, you've had a few girlfriends and stuff, haven't you?
Yeah.
But nothing at the minute.
Nothing at the minute.
Let's find out what happens after... Pacific Air went broke and you kicked out of Vietnam. The story's just begun with James Nixon, retired A380 captain with Emirates.
If it's a red threat, that means we're, you know, seriously, we believe it's true and we're going to tell you about it. The first thing I do as the pilot in command is contact them again, either by satellite phone. These days it was probably radio, maybe high frequency radio phone. And you say, just confirm you got the right airplane.
Important.
It's the most important thing, and most people miss that, you know, because they launch into these great procedures and they go, oh, sorry, I'm in flight number 21, not 31.
And suddenly another pilot.
That's it. You know, so you really want to make sure when you're talking about bombs, we've got to talk about it.
Yes, that was you. Who were you with there?
The famous Adam Shand, super journalist, TV presenter. And Adam Shand had a podcast, and I was talking about the bombs for the Qantas bombing. Remember the bomb scare for Qantas in the 1970s.
Yes. I've got a story where it was soon after 9/11, and a couple of the woodsmen, their sons were travelling across to America when it reopened up, and one was an Essendon supporter.
We're talking about Collingwood again, aren't we?
No, we're not talking about Collingwood, okay, right, but so it was one of the sons. The son of the guy I know was Collingwood, and his mate was Essendon. So they arrive at Los Angeles Airport, and there's a game on. And he's listening to on his internet feed of the game, and he's waiting for his bags to arrive. And in a close game, with 30 seconds to go, Essendon kick a goal, and he yells out, "Go Bombers!" at the baggage carousel. So, security guys...
up against the wall, against the wall. Cheeks.
That's right, the whole works. The whole shooting match. Question, take it out the back. He said, "I barrack for Essendon."
Yeah, what is Essendon, sir? You know, can we have an explanation about this?
Those guys got no sense of humour.
Oh, I know. So now, you were made captain, but they went bust. That was Pacific Air.
That's right. So then I got went down to start up another airline in Singapore called Tiger Airways.
Well, they're still going.
Well, they are. But I, while I was waiting to pass all the legislation, there's all these exams and medicals, 3 days of medicals to work in
Singapore. 3 days.
And while I was doing that, I got a job to fly an Airbus, brand new one, an A320 from the Cayman Islands to Bahrain for a Saudi sheikh who just bought a white A320.
Oh, so what was it doing in the Cayman Islands? He bought it from there.
They all get registered. In fact, we got Michael Schumacher's first registration, Victor Papa, which stands for the English Territory registrations.
Yeah.
Charlie Mike Sierra. Charlie for the Caymans and Mike Sierra for Michael Schumacher.
Ah, how about that? So you delivered, but that was only one flight for the Sheikh.
Yeah, one flight for the Sheikh, and got to Bahrain and met the Sheikh, and the Sheikh then decided to offer us fantastic money and conditions and make us work for him, flying his plane around, and made me the flight operations manager.
So you weren't flying it?
Yeah, flying it as
well. Oh, you were flying it, yeah, right. Yeah. So how long were you with him?
18 months.
Were you?
And then they decided to move us from Bahrain to Riyadh, and my view of Riyadh is that we don't go there ever again.
Is it better down at Tramada?
We sure as well don't live there. No, it's worse than Capel Sound.
No, Sounds all right. Used to be West Rose, but of course.
Right. It was better when we did the beach promotions at the Caravan Park.
That's right.
Anyway, so, I don't want to live in Saudi.
No.
Nice place to look at, but you wouldn't want to live there.
Yeah.
And so then left the Sheikh's employee and came back. Thought I might get a job at Jetstar. Not good enough yet. Still not good enough to get a job in Australia.
Really?
And Virgin haven't even replied to my application. How's that? Anyway, so then I decided to get a job with Emirates. And
so what was the process of getting that job? How did you do that?
Well, that's a 3-day process. You go to Emirates and they put you through a large number of tests, and there was 9 of us going for the tests, and I was the only one who got a job, so...
Well done.
Yeah, thank you.
And then you started off as a first officer on the Emirates A380.
A330. A380 was just being built then, so it was the A330.
Oh, of course.
And then the A330, then the A340, and that used to fly to Melbourne as a four-engine A340.
Yeah.
And then after that, we got the A380, and they needed us to go on the A380s as a first officer. Even though we were getting close to becoming captains on the A330, they said, "No, we need you to go on the A380 as FO to help the operation." We just started flying the A380. We only had 2 of them when I started in September 2008. And when I left, we had 93, and they've now got 113.
When that arrived, when the A380 came on the scene, I got on my motorbike and rode out to Tullamarine to watch the first one land that Qantas had brought out. And I looked up into the sky and saw it. I've got photos of it at about 300 feet. I reckon it came as on final over runway 3-4 at Tullamarine, is it? Mm-hmm. 3-4. Landing into the north at 3-4. And I thought, this is ugly, but this is going to change things long term from the jumbo jet that we've grown to know and love.
Mm. And it does, because if the Emirates A380 is full upstairs, everything downstairs is profit. And if it's full downstairs, everything upstairs is profit. It's just the most amazing airplane.
Ah.
We'd fly to Bangkok with a full airplane plus 2 cars underneath to go there for servicing. So you'd have a Lamborghini and a Porsche.
Two cars?
As well as all the passengers and all their cars.
And all the luggage.
Yeah. It's just a game changer. It makes so much money. And it's, you know, people talk about the 787 having a better cabin. Well, the A380 cabin is also very good. It's 5,800 feet, so it's like going to Mount to Falls Creek, whereas the 787 is like going to Mount Buller. And most aeroplanes are at the top of Mount Kosciuszko up at 8,400 feet. So it's a very, very comfortable cabin. That's why people love the A380 experience.
Yeah.
And Emirates has become the best company in the world at operating it.
Yes, and 114 of them. How many?
113.
How many does Qantas have? Because they're phasing them out now, aren't they?
12. They've got 12.
12, is that all?
Yeah, I think so. They've got 12.
Aren't Qantas phasing them out in favour of the Dreamliner, the 787?
I think that's what their plan is, but I think the passengers will drive it, and the passengers love the A380. And if your marketing department is good enough, the A380 is great.
Yeah.
But the airlines that only got two or three of them, or four of them, such as Malaysian and Thai and British Airways, Lufthansa, Air France, none of them have done very well because they really haven't committed to them.
Right.
And it's a big commitment. So once you commit to an airliner, you need to have at least 18 airplanes just to make one simulator work. So the way you operate a simulator, it operates for about 18 airplanes.
Yeah.
So there's all these training costs associated with something like an A380. Cabin crew training's huge. They've got to do emergency escape slides in mock-ups and all things like that.
Yeah,
So it costs a huge amount of money to have something like an A380. You've got to have a lot of them, and you've got to
big infrastructure behind it.
Yeah.
Training. You forget about that, don't you? And you've got to fill them. You've got to travel full.
Our ANSET head of cabin crew training, Catherine Baird, Essendon supporter from Melbourne, she ran the Emirates Cabin Crew Training Centre, 95 classrooms, 7 stories tall, 8 simulators, A380 simulator for the cabin crew, swimming pool, A330, 777, the most amazing operation you've ever seen.
This is over in Dubai.
In Dubai, run by Catherine Baird, who's just retired. But I think she's the first woman to be on a board at board level in a company like Emirates.
Yeah.
That operation there, when you go and see it, and you know, CNN have done movies about it, it's just the most amazing operation. That's the sort of thing you've got to have when you're committing.
Committing to the A380.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. How long did you live in Dubai for?
Ten years. Yeah.
We'll find out what that was like. We've also got to talk about your theory on what happened to MH370, 370. And I'm going to do it now before I wait any longer. And I wasn't going to, but I have to because you mentioned Dubai. Did you know the people in Dubai don't like the Flintstones?
No, Des. I didn't know that.
No, they don't. But the people in Abu Dhabi do.
Hopefully raise money. And when it came to Sydney Harbour, he couldn't help himself, and he flew it under Sydney Harbour Bridge. None of the crew knew he was going to do it. He said, they said, why did you do it? He said, because it was there.
Right.
And he got into a heap of trouble over it, but of course he's a bit of a hero, so they couldn't do too much to him. And would you believe, I think he was 90 when he walked across the top of Sydney Harbour at 90 years of age.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, vale to Peter Isaacson, a life, an extraordinary life, well lived. And thank you so much, James Nixon, for reminiscing on his life. That's James Nixon, retired A380 captain and author.
That was you with Tony Moclair talking about Peter Isaacson, one of your heroes.
He certainly was, and a good friend of my mum and dad's.
What
a superstar. Yeah. Not only did he... was he an amazing pilot? He was the head of the Pathfinders, so flying Lancaster bombers and other bombers, and he would go low level, hugging the ground, and they would lay the flare path for the bombers coming later on. Most amazing guy. He flew the Lancaster under Sydney Harbour Bridge when it came to Australia. It's now sitting in the War Memorial, G for George. And he stopped that and started Peter Isaacson Publications.
Oh, yes.
And pretty much every journo you've met in Melbourne started there in Porter Street, Peran, working for Peter Isaacson Publications.
Yeah, how about that? John has called through with a question for you, James. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, guys. James, I'm wondering on the law of averages, what is the best side of the plane to be seated in to when you're landing in Dubai, please?
Right, so you're coming from Australia to Dubai. What time of day are you getting there?
We're getting in early in the morning, so we're going in August, so it's getting in about 5:45, but it'd be probably more because then we're going from Dubai to Zurich. So it's probably more the actual takeoff to Zurich.
Right, takeoff to Zurich. Well, either way is the same because you're going to come in on the northern runway.
Well, it depends which way the wind's going too.
The katabatic wind.
The katabatic wind.
The katabatic wind.
Comes over the mountains.
Same as it here at Mount Macedon.
So yeah.
Same thing. So it's coming from the desert to the sea early in the morning when you arrive. So you'll be landing into the north. And you will be able to sit on the left-hand side and see the city of Dubai arriving as you land. And if you stay on the left-hand side for takeoff, what time that goes straight away? About 2 hours later at 8:30 in the morning, I think. So that flight then should be okay. Looking at the left-hand side, you'll see that the creek and also up Sheikh Zayed Road, a very good view of the islands and also the palm. Jumeirah.
Oh, yes, sounds wonderful. 10 years in Dubai. What a fascinating place. I've never been there, but you see photos and it looks just crazy.
Well, it's like Disneyland, but the thing is, like Disneyland, there's places for people to live and work who are working there. So, you know, you can either partake in the tourism thing, which a lot of people do, but if you live there, I lived in a place which is very similar to Albert Park, and it was next to the golf course. It was the first eco village there, so all our sewage and wastewater made the golf course look good, which makes me, every time I see Tiger Woods playing golf there, I go,
that grass is green.
Yeah.
That was fertilised by
and,
me.
And so it was a great little village to live in and good place, great people.
Now, some of the sites you've seen, speaking of landing at Dubai, as a captain of an A380, what do you see up there? Just everything.
You see everything. And of course, being night, long-haul flying, you're doing a lot of night flying, so you get to see the celestial bodies. You get very used to looking at the atmosphere above.
Yeah.
I think the good part about Dubai is you quite often fly over the North Pole going into Los Angeles or San Francisco. So you take off out of Dubai, you go east a little bit out of Dubai, then go straight up over Iran and then Georgia and then right over Russia, Murmansk. Straight over the top of the North Pole, come down over Canada.
What are the compasses doing then?
They go crazy. Above 72 degrees, the magnetic compass starts going a bit crazy.
It would too.
And the airplane, Airbus, automatically, if you don't touch it, it'll switch over to true north, and the compasses, aircraft compasses, reference true north. And you do that.
So you're at 30, no, you could be even at 40,000 feet, couldn't you? And you're the captain, you're the pilot in command of an A380 Airbus with how many packs, as you say, how many people on board?
Well, it's 576 usually. There's 29 other crew besides yourself. So we've got 30 crew. So you've got two sets of pilots. And then you've got about 545 passengers, and then 26 kids on knees, and dogs and cats as well.
And a couple of Ferraris sometimes in the hold, along with all the luggage. Yeah. Amazing stuff, James. Now, one of the five books you've written is called The Crash of MH370. Yeah. Now, I've watched the Netflix three-part series on it. Mm. This is my summation. It's the same as Azari Chamberlain the Dingo. No one really knows what's happened. There are a million theories going around, but at the end of the three-part series, I looked at it and thought, well, why have I watched that? Because I don't know what's happened, and we never will until they find the wreckage. What are your thoughts?
That's pretty much the truth. Yeah. That's exactly what it's about. So what you have to do is look at the evidence we've got.
We haven't got enough evidence.
Well, we have got a lot of evidence up until the time the plane went missing. Got a lot of evidence about that. And we can surmise something fairly important from that. So the plane's turned around and it's headed towards Penang. So what makes a plane turn around at altitude?
Well, the French journo, she reckons, is knocked out of the air by that American plane.
Yes.
And then you've got that Jeff Wise who changed his theories about 18 times.
Yes. Kazakhstan. Yes.
Kazakhstan.
Yes. Nah.
Nah. Yeah, nah. Yeah, nah. Yeah, nah.
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 And so what we do know is the plane turned around quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a thing called Occam's Razor. It's a science project. Yeah, I know all about this stuff because I'm a failed science loser.
Yeah.
Occam's
because
Razor.
The dream buster.
The dream stealer.
The dream stealer.
And so I found out with Occam's Razor, the most plausible thing is probably correct. And the thing that happens most of all in aeroplanes is a smoke, fire, fume event. In fact, they happen one every 2,000 flights, which is about 59 times a day. Worldwide, you have a smoke, fire, fume event. And it could be as simple as something burning in the galley which happens a fair bit.
Like burnt toast.
Like burnt toast, but usually burnt things inside the ovens because they actually use the ovens as storage before they take off.
Right.
And they start the ovens up and they might have something burned there.
Like a tea towel.
Like a tea towel. You can have passengers' baggage going off with batteries, lithium batteries in the overhead bins. You could have people having fires in their seat when they move their phone after dropping their phone down the automatic seat and they move it back and squash the phone.
Ah, right.
You can have air conditioning smoke. You can have electrical smoke when something pops, a circuit breaker pops, and there's a tiny bit of smoke associated with that when it...
Right,
when
which is nothing. Stops,
which is nothing.
It's nothing.
And the cabin crew are trained firefighters, so they're very, very good at that.
Right.
But a big smoke fire fumes event, and they don't happen very often, but the first thing the pilots do is turn to the nearest airport, and then they descend.
The alternate.
To the alternate. And they've got alternates all the time. Every captain knows where they're going to land right away because you can't stay afloat flying in an aeroplane aloft, flying for more than about 25 minutes
yeah.
with a fully involved fire. You must land somewhere.
Yeah.
And so they always know where they're going to turn to. Depressurization, which all these people talk about, depressurization, you descend first and then you turn. You've got 1,000 feet to go because you've got to turn off the airway in case there's someone coming the other way or there's someone below you.
Yeah.
So you descend first, then you turn. This aeroplane turned first and then they started a descent, but it wasn't fully initiated. And I think they must have been dead before they've started the descent. And it's just flown along. No autopilot. And we know it's no autopilot because the radius of the turn, the speed they were going. So we know that they've disconnected the autopilot and turned, and that's what 90% of pilots do in the simulator in a smoke fire fumes event.
Interesting. 5 to 10. James, if people want to read your book, The Crash of MH370, or 23 Tips to Survive a Long Flight, or Sleeping for Pilot and Cabin Crew and Other Insomniacs, how do they go about that?
Well, they can go to jamesnixonbooks.com, or you can get it online from Amazon and get it electrically. Really cheap, the electronic books.
Okay.
Really cheap.
Just look Kindle up James Nixon and MH370. It should
or
come
JamesNixon.com.
up. JamesNixon.com. You're retired now. I see you down at the Albert Park Fishing and Anglers Club.
We should talk about that place one day.
That's a lovely spot.
The work
spot.
They're doing for the shellfish reef restoration, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. It's a credit to you. You persevered to become a pilot after... We started off the conversation. I never knew about the dream. What do we call him?
The dream stealer.
The dream stealer. After that 10 years hiatus in your formative years, you could have been flying at 16, but the dream stealer said, you're no good at maths, you'll never be able to make it. But like the Alan Bond commercials, you made it all right. Retired A380 captain with Emirates, James Nixon, thanks for coming in and talking to us.
My pleasure. You only get one Alan Bond once in your life.
On that note, stand by for the doc and the news. Sunday morning is next here on 3AW 693.